In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 4 p.m. on Tuesday, March 14th, in the Beckman Center Auditorium on the U of I campus, the Geological Survey presents a public lecture titled Hot Water, Minerals, and Life on the Ocean Floor, What Black Smokers Tell Us, by Dr. James M. Franklin, consulting geologist and retired chief geoscientist for the Geological Survey of Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. On the program today, a conversation with novelist Dara Horn. Her new novel, The World to Come, begins with the theft of a Chagall painting. The thief, Ben Ziskind. A former child prodigy, he is a 5'6", legally blind fellow who for a living writes questions for a television quiz show. The theft? It was impulsive. It seems the painting had once belonged to his family. It had belonged to his mother, Rosalie's family. As Ben makes off with the painting, the story widens, and Dara Horn takes us into the history of the painting and the Ziskind family. If you read this book, you'll find yourself transported around the globe across some of the darkest moments of the 20th century. You'll find yourself in 1920s Russia, where Chagall, an illustrious Yiddish writer known as Der Nister, the Hidden One, taught Jewish boys whose parents had been killed in the pogroms. You'll also find yourself in Vietnam, where Daniel Ziskind, Ben's father, survived an ambush. Let me share a sentence from the book's description with you. As Ben tries to evade the police, he and his twin sister, Sarah, seek out the truth of how the painting got to the museum, whether the original is actually a forgery, and whether Sarah, an artist, can create a convincing forgery to take its place. Here, then, is a tale of family, of survival, of truth and deception, a story of past and present and the world to come. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest, novelist Dara Horn. You can join the discussion with questions and comments. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dara Horn, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. This was one of the most complicated stories to sum up in an introduction.
Perhaps. Well, I think that actually my first book, I used to live on the 31st floor of an apartment building, and I found that I couldn't describe it when I left my apartment to when I got to the lobby. So that was even more complicated. But this one, I think, is it's multi-layered, but it does have sort of the surface story, which is about this art heist. And that is, you know, sort of the core of the book is the story of this painting. And it's stuff from this museum and also its history. So you have that as the topmost layer of the story. But as your introduction indicated, it is a multi-layered story that does go back in time from the current moment set in contemporary New York of this theft to historical periods prior to that, and really covers a lot of important moments in the 20th century. I think that, it can be enjoyed on all different levels. Mm-hmm. I think it can be enjoyed as just an art heist book, but I think it also can be read on different levels. You know, as a historical novel, and also as a novel about, as you said, some of the larger themes of truth and also of religious faith as well.
Yeah, I would hope people wouldn't read it just as an art theft caper kind of story. Now, the jumping off point for you, though, as a writer in this story, was the true story of a theft of a Chagall. What happened and why did that story capture your imagination?
Sure. This did really happen. People often think writers get their ideas from some obscure muse that comes down and blesses them with some idea. I actually got this idea from the front page of the newspaper. There was a big Chagall exhibit at a museum in New York where I live several years ago, and they had a singles mixer at this museum one evening, like a cocktail party, and someone walked into this singles mixer and walked out with this million-dollar painting. It was a very small painting, maybe 8 inches by 10 inches. It's assumed that the person was able to just slip it under their jacket or something and left. And so when I saw this, when I heard about this theft, I was, you know, very intrigued by it because, you know, it's the sort of thing that really captures a novelist's imagination. You know, what kind of person would do this? What kind of person, you know, walks into a singles mixer and instead of walking out with someone's phone number, walks out with a $1 million painting? But the story caught my eye for more personal reasons also. In my academic life, which is sort of my second career, I'm a scholar of Yiddish literature. I'm finishing a doctorate in Hebrew and Yiddish literature. And when I heard about this theft, I thought about all of the Yiddish writers whose works I had studied who had their works illustrated by Chagall. And I started wondering how he had known them. And when I looked into it, I discovered that he had met many of these writers during the very unusual and very little known start of his own career. When Chagall was a young man, one of his first jobs, as you mentioned in your introduction, was as an art teacher at an orphanage in Russia for Jewish children who had been orphaned by the pogroms. And he writes about this in his memoirs, and he says that he was astounded by how these children who had been so traumatized by their experiences really saw art as a sort of redemptive act. And they really, as he put it, they threw themselves at colors like wild beasts at meat. And as a writer, I was really moved by this idea that art could somehow redeem us from a trauma or a suffering in the past. But when I found out more about this particular orphanage, I discovered something really fascinating, which is that nearly every person who taught at this particular orphanage was a major avant-garde artist or writer. And they all lived there in faculty housing together and collaborated on all kinds of projects. And from there, I saw that this wasn't just a story about an art theft, because if I was to put this in a novel, I had the opportunity to not just write the story of this theft, but also really the story of Chagall and these Yiddish writers who used to be part of his personal circle, and really about their divergent fates, about how what happened to Chagall from this very humble beginnings that he had versus what happened to his colleagues in the Soviet Union whom he had lived with as a young man.
Yeah. So was there really the hidden one?
Yes. There's two of the major characters in the book. Chagall, everyone knows, is a real person. But the other very few people know about is this character, Der Nester, which, as you said, means the hidden one. He really was a Yiddish writer. He really did teach at this orphanage, and he really was Chagall's roommate there in faculty housing. They lived together in faculty homes with their families. When they both were teaching at this orphanage, Chagall was teaching art, and Der Nester was teaching literature. And not only were they roommates, but they also were friends. And not only were they friends, but they also were collaborators. And in fact, Der Nester wrote a number of Yiddish children's stories that were illustrated by Chagall. So it was quite a fruitful collaboration that they had. But what happened after that really was fascinating to me. Chagall, of course, thereafter, you know, went to the West. He became French. He became world famous. His paintings now hang in museums around the world. Mm-hmm. They're printed on Hallmark cards. Meanwhile, by the early 1950s, almost everyone else who had taught at this orphanage with him had been executed by Stalin, who had decided to destroy a culture by murdering Jewish writers and artists. And this is very much what happened to Der Nester. Der Nester also had many great accomplishments as a young man, as Chagall had. His stories had been published and very much renowned and acclaimed by critics. He really had an amazing career ahead of him. But in the Soviet Union, his writing became more and more repressed. Soon the regime made it impossible for him to publish stories in the style he had developed. And ultimately, he was arrested and perished in a gulag. And the records show that he died in a prison hospital in 1950. So I was really interested in sort of what happens to these two people. One, you know, they start out in such similar careers, in such similar positions. One goes on to be world famous. Everyone's heard of him. Another, I have to be on this broadcast explaining that yes, he's a real person, and he's, you know, and yes, he's a talented artist, and this is why we should have heard of him, but we haven't. What determines what makes one person famous and one not? And what I realized when I started thinking about this more is that we often think that time will tell the value of an artist's work, but I think that the more I learned about this circle of artists, the more I realized that what lasts may not necessarily be what's best. And that was really an idea that I wanted to explore in this novel.
Yeah, yeah. Pincus Kahanovich.
Yes, that was his real name.
Yeah. Has his life been examined in biography?
Really not. I mean, there's been there are some of his stories that are available in translation in English. He had one sort of massive novel that he wrote called The Family Crisis, also known as The Family Mashbar. Sort of like the name of the family is Crisis, the Crisis Family. That's the title of the book. And this novel has been published in English, but only the first two volumes have been published, and that's because he was arrested before the last volume was published. And in fact, there's sort of a sad story about this. When the Soviet secret police came to his apartment to arrest him, according to his wife, they asked him to hand over his manuscript for the last volume of this trilogy of this novel. And he said to them, "Forgive me, gentlemen, but I didn't write it for you. My manuscript remains in a safe place." Unfortunately, it's never surfaced since then, so no one really knows what happened to it. But no, there haven't really been very many biographical studies of his work. His prison records have been published in a volume with Mandelstam, who is another Russian writer who perished in the Gulag. But I think that there really hasn't been very much attention given to him, and he really was one of the greats of Yiddish literature. And I was interested in sort of in this book, giving him another opportunity at life, because, and not just him, but also sort of giving many Yiddish writers another opportunity at life, because this is a whole culture that very few people know anything about today. And I really wanted in this book to make it not just available, but accessible to general readers, because I think that there's just such riches in this literature that that really very few people know about now.
Hmm. Can you give us a sense of the stories that he wrote, that he told?
Of Dernister's work?
Yeah. What are the major themes?
They're very, very strange. They change. The beginning of his work, he has stories that are quest narratives. They're very sort of almost like fables. And, for example, there'll be a story of a man who's wandering around the world trying to find sort of a kernel of truth, and he sort of encounters all kinds of wizards and things that are trying to help him find this kernel of truth. It's a very sort of symbolic story, and it sort of really has this belief that storytelling itself produces a kind of redemption. But then what happens is his stories, as he developed his style, his stories become more and more tangled, and it gets to the point where if I tried to describe what one of his stories is about, you would almost not believe that this is something that you could read. For instance, he has a story called From My Estates, which begins with, there's so many layers to this story, but the center of it is about a man who is living in a home with 10 bears that are trying to eat him alive. And he starts trying to convince these bears to let him live. And he tries to convince them to let him live by describing how he got into the situation. Now, how did he get into this situation? He says that one day he saw a ladder leading up to the sky. He climbed this ladder into the sky, and he found himself in a kingdom made of mud. As he's traveling through this kingdom made of mud, he soon finds that everyone in this kingdom of mud hates him because he's the only person there who doesn't get sick from eating all of this filth. And then he escapes from this kingdom made of mud to a kingdom made of gold, where he gathers some of the gold and he manages to amass great wealth. But eventually, when he amasses this great wealth, he has a tremendous ball to celebrate his success, and he invites the constellations down from the sky to dance with him. And one of the constellations he invites down is Ursa Major, the Great Bear. And the Great Bear wants to dance with him, but says that, with all of your wealth, you never could even feed 10 of my own, 10 of my own children. And then she casts him down from heaven to earth. Eventually, when he's on Earth, he starts telling people stories of these things he's experienced, and he's assumed to be insane. So he's put in an insane asylum, and in the insane asylum, he goes into a delirium. And during his delirium, he imagines that he has entered into this aware of these bears that are eating him alive. So there's sort of, it's very strange, as you can tell just from the description, it's completely absurd. But it's more than just absurd. There's sort of, there's so many layers of meaning that are in it. There's symbolism, of course. There's this idea that, you know, the bears, of course, very much evocative of the Soviet Union and the pressures that writers had to deal with in terms of being told what, you know, sort of subjecting themselves to the demands of the state. But there's also, there's so many more layers to it. There's this idea of what is real and what is not. You know, it's because at the beginning when we read about him sort of feeding all these bears, we think, okay, this is the reality of the story as we know it. So that's, that makes sense to me. But then at the end, it turns out that this is his delirium as an insane person. But since it's from his point of view, we think of him as he was wrongly put into the insane asylum. So really, it makes you really wonder, what does it mean to be crazy? What does it mean to be sane? Are there aspects of our life or our society that really are nuts? And if we disagree with them, then it's not that we're nuts, but rather that the world around us is. Where are those lines drawn? And, you know, really, really they're very complicated stories and very demanding on the reader, but they raise so many questions. And the real questions are, what is, and the essential question in all of his stories, I think, is, does storytelling offer us redemption? Is there a point to telling stories? And it often was thought in Yiddish culture that storytelling was a kind of redemption because this was a culture that lived without its own country and really lived in texts. Cultural transmission always happened through stories and through texts. And so it was believed that storytelling was really an act of redemption that could save people and would allow a person to survive into the future. And his stories sort of question that and raise the issue of, is that really possible, and or are we relying too much on art? Are we investing too much in fantasy? And he asks us to question the reality that we live in.
Yeah. You know, I have some questions to ask you that that are related, and I was thinking about these, and I was thinking about asking them later in the interview, but I think I'm going to ask them now. I imagine these questions were on your mind as you wrote The World to Come. How are we, for better or for worse, shaped by our experiences? What do we do? What can we do with the bad stuff? And what are your thoughts about art as a response to life, the good and the bad, as, you know, art as redemption?
Big questions. Very big questions. The question about being shaped by one's experiences is one that is very important in this book. Because in this book, we have characters. Let's start with this. In life, we rarely have the opportunity to look back on our own experiences or on the experiences of our family or our national history or our cultural history and see exactly what it was that brought us to this point. Occasionally, we can sort of guess at those things, but very rarely are we able to really see them. One of the most exciting things about fiction is that you can, in effect, reverse cause and effect. So in other words, you have a present moment that you begin with, and then you actually have an opportunity to create a past that caused the present. In other words, in my novel, I have this man walks into this museum and steals this painting. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, well, why does he steal this painting? And then I have the opportunity to create this past for this man and for this painting that led him to this moment. But the question is, you know, as you phrased it, is, you know, are we shaped by our experiences? How much can we escape from what our experiences have done for us? I think that in this book you have characters who are faced with many choices. And the choices, but what's, I think, is makes this novel perhaps unusual. I mean, that's true in any novel, of course. But I think what makes this novel unusual is that you see the impact of the choices that each character makes on all of the other characters, and not just in one generation, but in subsequent ones. So each character is confronted with an opportunity to do something with his experiences. That character's choices have impact beyond that character's life. So a simple example. In the beginning of the book, we have there's a scene where Chagall and Dernister are teaching in this orphanage, mm-hmm. and they meet one of the pogrom survivors. One of their students is a child who has witnessed his parents' murder and is now has had the opportunity to be sent to this orphanage. for the rest of his childhood. And we see there's this scene where we see sort of him and all of the other boys who live in this dormitory with him in this orphanage, and how they're really all experiencing this trauma. They have nightmares where they sleep, where each person is reliving their experiences at night by sleepwalking and these kinds of things. But in the next day, there's an art class. And this boy goes to this art class, and when Chagall teaches Chagall's instruction in the art class, he tells the students to paint something that they've seen. He then remembers something that his mother had told him about birth. His mother had been pregnant at the time when they of the pogrom, and she prior to this had told him that a story of which is a part of Jewish legends, which is what happens to a baby before it's born. And she says that before children are born, each of them are taught all of the secrets of the world, everything they might ever want or need to know once they're alive. But just before they're born, an angel puts a finger to the child's lips and says, shh, don't tell the secrets. Hmm. And at that moment, the child forgets everything that he or she has learned. And after their birth, they have to spend the rest of their lives trying to remember. This is a story from Jewish legend, and I think it's a very poignant story, and we all sort of hear it and say, oh, that's so sweet. But I think it's also a very disturbing story, because it suggests that this world that we live in is sort of in a way is a void, and that we're cast into it at birth really as a blank slate, that we have this whole world in front of us and we don't know what we can do with it. So in this case of this boy, he paints this, when he's asked to paint something that he's seen in his mind's eye, he paints this image of this baby in a womb. And what this painting does is it gives him an opportunity to have this interaction with Chagall and Durnester. And what the result of this interaction is that he then is given a painting by Chagall and a story by Durnester, which then become part of his something that is passed down through his family and has tremendous impact on each of the people in his family that it touches later. But the reason that this all began was because he had sort of the ability to take something that he had experienced, and in fact he had seen his mother's murder while she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. But he takes that experience and turns it into a painting based on this legend, and really sort of, an uplifting story in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that, but what we see toward the end of his life is that while this does give a kind of redemption and a kind of survival to his family in the future, his life and his fate is sealed in many ways beyond his control. So the larger question is, do we have control over our own lives? Or are we shaped by the experiences that we have and those people who came before us? I think that it's not true that we're shaped by our experiences, which we can't control. But what I do think is true is that we're shaped by how we respond to our experiences, what we do with those experiences once they've happened. And I think that that's what we see happening in each of the characters in this book every time they're faced with a choice. What shapes them and their future is the choice that they make at the moment when they're presented with the free choice. As for the question of art and art being a redemptive force, I think it is and it isn't. In this book, we see how it is something that unites people, but it's also something that divides people. We like to think that art, belongs to the world, and it's sort of something that's, everybody in the culture can enjoy it. But in fact, if that were true, then no one would be upset when somebody walks out, of a museum stealing a painting. It's not true that art belongs to everyone. And so once you're confronted with that question, you have to ask why. And also, I think that there's sort of, in many ways, each member of this family is faced with some kind of aggression. In each generation, there's a repeated aggression from the outside. Each person, in each generation of the family, they find themselves in a situation, whether it's a pogrom or a war or something like that, where there's really a violent aggression against them. And what you do see in the book is that art has no protection against those kinds of things. Well, the only thing art does is it's reactive. It's not prescriptive. It's reactive. It's a way of dealing with one's experiences once they've happened. And whether or not that can form a redemption, I think, is really anyone's guess. And I think that there's some, in my novel, that question is really left open. There's the ending of my novel is actually quite ambiguous. It can be read in one of several ways, and I guess I shouldn't give very much away about that.
Yeah, don't.
But I've made it ambiguous quite deliberately, because it kind of is up to what kind of reader you are, how you think this novel should end.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, we have here literally the canvas, and then metaphorically, a canvas.
Yes. in physically, you mean with the painting that's taken through the generations? Yes, because there's this image that Chagall creates. Ultimately, what happens when it first is given to this boy, his housemate, Der Nister, puts a story of his into the back of the canvas. And later becomes not just this story, not just this painting that's stolen, in effect, but the story that's stolen also. And that, as you said, it's a physical thing, but it's also a metaphorical thing. Because one thing that I noticed with when I read about this theft that happened, you know, as in real life, I remember the newspaper story that I read said that it took the museum almost an entire day to notice that this painting had been stolen, which is perhaps part of the security problem at the museum. I don't know, but I think that when we hear that, we're kind of astonished, like how could they not have noticed? But when I heard that, I was sort of thought to myself that the stories that were written by Chagall's former friends or colleagues have been missing for over 50 years without anyone noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this novel, we have this painting is stolen, but the stories by Chagall's friends are also stolen, in effect. They're plagiarized and published under an American writer's name because she figures who will ever notice if she takes all of her plots from Yiddish literature.
Yeah.
And in fact, she's right. And so, and that also raises these questions about who owns a work of art. You know, would we be, you know, if it were true that the whole world owns a work of art, it would be okay to steal paintings from museums and it would be okay to plagiarize another writer's work. But in fact, it isn't. And if it isn't, then what does it mean to own a work of art? What does it mean for something to be, for a work of art to be yours? And the novel really raises a lot of those questions, too.
Yeah. Well, also we have the question of history. Whose history is it? And how do histories get lost?
Which I think is a really astonishing thing. I think that we like to think that history is kind of a writer of wrongs. I think that we like to believe that, you know, as I said earlier, that time will tell the value of an artist's work,
mm-hmm.
And that, you know, sort of everything comes out in the wash and people get what they deserve. I think that the story of the Yiddish writers in the Soviet Union is exactly the opposite. What we see is writers getting exactly what they didn't deserve, because these were writers who were, we often like to think that they were dissidents or something like that, that they were going against the government and they were speaking out. And, you know, this is sort of the whole, you know, story of freedom we like to tell ourselves about the Cold War. The truth is that these Yiddish writers actually were devoted to the Soviet Union. They really believed in the communist system. They really believed that this was the place where Yiddish-speaking life would flourish. And, in fact, they were really completely betrayed by Stalin, who really turned around and murdered them all. And it was quite a shock to all of these writers when the purge began, when they started arresting these writers. It was really a surprise to people. And so this question of, you know, of history sort of working things out, I think is really not true, because this is first of all, these crimes are not very well known, and, you know, the crimes of the state were not very well known. And I think also there's, and this culture that was destroyed is completely forgotten. And I think it's also true that what intrigued me most as a novelist about this particular history was the way it raises the question of trust. These were writers who really trusted this society to support them and then were completely betrayed. And what it made me wonder is, what is it that makes what makes it possible to be betrayed? And I think what it is a person needs to have a certain level of generosity and kindness in order to be betrayed, because it's that generosity that led you to trust the person who you shouldn't have trusted. So in a way, it's betrayal is sort of the worst, in some ways, it's the worst kind of punishment, or not punishment, the worst kind of aggression a person can endure, because it's, in effect, it's a punishment for being kind, for being, you know, quote, foolish enough to, you know, extend your hand to someone, to trust them. And so that's something that happens in this book over and over again, in a sort of historical way, as you said, with the experience in the Soviet Union. There's the experience in the Vietnam War, of course, for our country, was something where there was this betrayal was experienced in many different directions. I think that, but also it's something that appears just in simple relationships in the book. There's several love stories in this book, but also you see romantic relationships in which people are betrayed, and you see sort of the cause of the betrayal being really a trust that we have in another person. And the real question it raises, I think, is, you know, once you know this, once you know that people will take advantage of you, how do you trust anyone? And of course, the answer to that is, well, how can you go through your life without trusting anyone?
Yeah. That would be to stop living, in a sense, wouldn't
it? Yes. Right. Well, and I think that, you know, and because trust is really the beginning of love. At one point, I realized I'd written a book where, as I said, there's several love stories in this book. But there's only one place in the entire book where someone says, I love you. And that person proves that they don't mean it completely, very brutally, two sentences later. And when I look back through the book, I saw that all of the love stories that take place in this book actually don't begin with the words, I love you, but they do begin with the words, I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think there's trust that really, unfortunately, it's such a dangerous thing, but it is, as you said, one of the only things that gives our lives meaning.
Yeah. Dara Horn is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest novel is The World to Come. It is her second novel. She's at work on her doctorate in Hebrew and Yiddish literature at Harvard University. Her first novel, In the Image, was critically acclaimed, as is now The World to Come. In the Image received 3 National Jewish Book Awards, and it was named one of the best novels of 2002 by the San Francisco Chronicle and the Christian Science Monitor. The World to Come is also receiving excellent reviews. Both books, In the Image and The World to Come, are published by W.W. Norton. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions or comments for our guest, Dara Horn. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. There's an interesting encounter way at the beginning of the book, at the museum, before Ben snatches the painting. An encounter between Ben and some women. And now Ben is at this singles event at the urging of his sister, and he just doesn't want to be there.
Does anyone ever want to be at a singles
right. event? one of the women is trying to engage him, and she's a member of the museum staff, Erica Frank. And she asks him if he speaks a foreign language, and he replies, Yiddish. And she's very surprised. Where does the encounter go from there?
She then says that, she thinks that, she asks how he had learned it from his whether he'd learned it from his grandparents. And he says he actually learned it from his father. She then asks, do you still speak it with your father? And he says, no, my father's dead. This is obviously quite a conversation killer, and he's quite aware of that. And he's, quite pleased that is, because he's quite resentful of being there. But then she says, what has always impressed me about Yiddish is how there's so much humor in it. And he then says, actually, there's no more humor in it than there is in any other language. But what Yiddish does have, and what you don't know it has because it's not in any Woody Allen movies, is a world of the dead built into it, and a need to invoke the presence of God whenever mentioning anything good or bad happening to anyone. And I think that is true. I think that a lot of what we think of as Yiddish culture, unfortunately in this country, I think that there's the impression that a lot of people have of Yiddish, if they have any impression at all, is that this is a funny language. I don't think it's possible for a language to be funny. I think it's possible for speakers in a language to be funny. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's anything inherently funny in it, one language or another. But what is true, and as Ben says it in the novel, or thinks it in the novel, is that I do think Yiddish does have this sort of awareness of another world. And what I mean by that is it's a very inflected language. Every time that a speaker remarks on something happening in a future event, good or bad, there are certain reflexive phrases that one uses, to ward off the evil eye, or to prevent, to hope for the best outcome. And I think that what that really, and that's something we don't really have in English. We have sort of the only reflexive things we have in English maybe is, when someone sneezes, we say bless you. And most of us are not even, we don't even think about the religious implications of that. But in Yiddish, there are a lot more phrases like that. First of all, when someone sneezes in Yiddish, there are up to 7 things that one says with each subsequent sneeze of various blessings that one gives to the person who sneezes. But there's really just, if you mention a person who's passed away, you wish that their memory would be a blessing anytime you say their name. If you would mention anything something that would happen in the future, you would say that it should happen in a fortunate hour. You could look at this just as superstition, which it very much is. But I think you can also look at it as a culture that has that chooses to think of the world as a place that where one can't control everything. And I think this is completely opposed to modern American culture, where we really do believe that, we live in a really rational society, or at least we like to think that we do, where, you know, everything is something that we can control. Problems are things that we can solve. Anything that happens to us really is something that we can improve. And it's all sort of, we have the potential to do all of this. In Yiddish culture, you have this, you do have a faith in human progress, but you also have an awareness that there are things that happen to us in life that are beyond our control and that are beyond any rational understanding that we have. And I think that the place that we see that even in secular life is on the edges of life, at birth and death. No matter how rational or secular we are, we still have to, we still are faced with this unanswerable question at the edges of life, which is, how can a person who just existed suddenly not exist anymore? Or how could a person who never existed suddenly exist? These are things that we just cannot explain, and there isn't any way to explain it. And that's why in this book there's so much focus on those edges of life, on birth and on death, because those are the moments when modern secular culture doesn't have any answers.
Yeah. Well, here is where I really started to like Ben very much. When he is thinking about Yiddish, where he says, it's a world of the dead built into it, a true fear of heaven, an automatic need to invoke the presence of God whenever saying anything good or bad about anyone or anything, an absolute trust that the other world, if one could call it that, is not separate from this one, that eternity is always breathing over your shoulder, waiting to see if you will notice. It's good stuff.
Well, but this is really it is the outlook of this culture, and I think it's something that it haunts a modern secular reader because it evokes that kind of that awareness of the limits of our understanding of the world, of anyone's limits of our understanding of the world. Freud has an essay called The Uncanny, where he talks about how there's when we see something strange that we don't understand, a coincidence, a dream about someone who's passed away, even the most rational person will still sort of be disturbed by it or haunted by it. And Freud says that that's a relic of a primitive man. I don't think it's a relic of primitive man. I think it is man. Mm-hmm. I think it's that aspect of our awareness is really what I would call a soul. That we can explain so many things in our lives. You know, 99.9% of our lives, we can somehow explain and find solutions for. But then there's that tiny percentage, which is, as Ben puts it, the eternity that's breathing over our shoulder, waiting to see that if we'll notice. And I do think that's one thing that art can give us is an awareness of that eternity breathing over our shoulder. Art is something I think that helps to make us notice.
Mm. As I mentioned, Ben is there at this singles event at the urging of his sister, his twin sister. What would you like to say about Sarah and the relationship between brother and sister here in this novel?
That's actually, many people ask me if there's any aspects of this book that come from my own life. I'm not a twin, but I am one of four siblings. We're very close to each other in age, and we're all in creative fields. My two sisters are also published writers, and my brother is an artist and an animator, and we often collaborate together on projects. Mm. And I was interested in exploring this relationship between adult siblings, because I think that as we get older, there are fewer and fewer people in our lives who have known us when we were children. And the potential that we have that relationship has between adult siblings is really quite amazing, because this is someone who knows you as an adult, also knew you as a child. And unlike a friend, is someone who sort of is unconditionally connected to you. And unlike a parent, is someone who sees you as a peer. And I think, unlike a parent or a child, is someone who sees you as a peer. There are very few people in our lives who do that. Obviously, many people's relationships with their siblings are far from
Rocky.
Positive. But, that's unfortunate. But I was interested in sort of looking at the potential of that relationship. And so you have in this novel these two twins, Ben and Sarah, brother and sister. But the reason I chose and made them twins also is to make it really that their lives are so similar and their upbringing is so similar, but yet their outlooks on the world could not be more different. Ben is, as you said, he was a child prodigy. I think the way I put it in the book is he was a child prodigy who's, at the age of 30 has come to the horrible realization that there's no such thing as an adult prodigy. And he is, as you mentioned earlier, he makes his living writing quiz questions for a TV quiz show. And really, and well, this is not true of necessarily of anyone who has this job, but he doesn't just have this job, but this is his life in some way. He really sees the world in trivialities. His sister could not be more different. She's an artist. She's a painter. And she sees the world in colors and in patterns. And she's able to see colors and patterns in the world that other people do not notice. She almost has this uncanny ability to see beyond what most people can see. And the two of them are able to sort of work together in this way because they're opposites. And ultimately, Sarah ends up becoming somewhat complicit in this theft, and as an artist is able to sort of lend her skills to find a way to get Ben out of this situation that he's gotten himself into. So you see sort of the combination of the artistic and the practical in their relationship. But really, I wanted to explore that possibility of what that relationship can be. And I feel very lucky that it's something that I have in my own life.
Yeah. I think another one of the reasons their relationship is so moving and they are so close is that because both of their parents are gone now, both of them are deceased. That makes a difference too, doesn't it?
Yes, because suddenly they're the only people who've known each other as children. I mean, friends here and there, but there's suddenly they're the only people left in their families.
I think at that point in your life too, you really have a sense of mortality.
Yes, that is when the eternity breathing over your shoulder has become much, much louder.
It's palpable.
When you're sort of the oldest one, not just the only one, but the oldest one in your family. Mm-hmm. And that's why a bunch of this book is also focused on the future. We find out very close to the beginning of the book that Sarah's pregnant. And you have, of course, Ben's conflicting feelings about this. He, of course, he's actually just coming out of a divorce, does not have children. Of course, quite jealous of his sister in many ways. But also you see sort of him investing this future in her child, that this is finally going to be a new person in their family that will be given one of their parents' names.
Yeah.
And there's this sense that the dead can be revived in those who have yet to be born. And that's a metaphor that's explored with a fair amount of depth in this book.
Yeah. We've got a listener phoning in now, and we're coming down on time, so I want to get to the listener.
Sure.
I also want to ask you about this. This was interesting. I gleaned this piece of information from some material that came from the publisher, Norton. You were expecting your first child when you were finishing this book.
Yes.
I wonder how this book affected you during your pregnancy and your thinking about giving birth.
Well, it was in some ways. I only became pregnant toward the end of writing the book, so a lot of the ideas in the book were already sort of set in motion.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end of the book, and this doesn't give anything away in terms of plot, there's a scene where that takes place in this world before birth, where this child is studying all of these secrets, and I found that, it's a scene where. That all those metaphors in the book are sort of become literal. But I have to admit that it was something that I was thinking about very much as sort of, when you're pregnant, it's very shocking to think that there's this person inside you who isn't you. And who will eventually have their own thoughts and their own dreams and their own wishes that are not yours. And it's a very frightening thing, as well as a very exciting thing. Of course, I always wondered, well, what secrets is this person learning? And I kind of wondered that for my own life and for my own child. Of course, after my daughter was born, I realized that the secrets babies have really forgotten, or the secrets have had to sleep through the night.
Let's talk with this.
She's starting to learn that one again now.
let's talk with this listener who's waiting for us now, Ian Champagne on line one. Hi.
Hi. Shalom Aleichem. Since you're talking about the Yiddish world, and you were talking about things like Olam Haba and all these other things, the world to come.
Yes.
And all the language that comes when you mention someone who's dead and you say Olav HaShalom, and et cetera. Really, that's a reflection of a Yiddish culture that's connected to religiosity. And to a great extent, I mean, I read your book, and the Yiddish literature culture was, especially in the Soviet Union, was anti-religious, and to a certain extent made a point of denying a lot of the religious roots of Yiddish culture. So really you've got two different Yiddish cultures that are reflected. And I wonder how much the one that you're portraying in terms of the Nister and the others in that Yiddish culture really have those religious themes only as remnants, but no longer really were connected to that in their everyday life of literature and culture and art, etc.
And Dara, I can only give you about a minute, 2 minutes tops.
Okay, sure. It's a good question. It's true that the Soviet Union was very anti-religious, and not only, as you put it, it wasn't just the Soviet Union. Actually, in modern Yiddish culture, in the beginning of the 20th century, there was very much a reaction against religion, and really before that even, I would say, in the late 19th century, reaction against religion. And that's very much part of the culture. But I think that what interested me most in the writers that I was exploring and whose works I sort of included in this book or alluded to in this book were the writers who, even though they themselves were secular, were still wrestling with these questions of religion. And those questions of religion were something that really animated their work, even if it was in a negative way, of these were people who were trying to live a secular life. But yet there's, I think, even in the most secular works, always sort of, as you said, they write about it as a remnant. And many of them, you know, and the ones who are quite disdainful of religion do write it explicitly as a remnant and put it down very severely.